We are finally back with our new season, season two, episode one of Habibi House Podcast. I am one of your hosts, SHL Hoob, and today I will be riding solo as both of my other co-hosts, Talal and Atif, are spending time with their families right now. And as you may know, as Palestinians and Lebanese, our families are actively being torn apart by outside forces, so being present with them when you can is more important than ever. So much has transpired since our last episode, obviously in lots of ways, but especially in the Middle East. But we have the perfect guest to provide some insight for the future in this country and globally, and I'm excited to get into some analysis with him. You may have seen his videos where he is power walking down the street, hair gloriously blowing in the wind. As he breaks down current events, he may be your rapid-fire news source on IG or Twitter. And when things often go to shit, he's someone I know I look for an explanation. He is a former United States Army Ranger who served four combat deployments during America's occupation of Afghanistan. He has a practical background in special operations and military intelligence, and is currently an anti-war activist and independent journalist based out of Austin, Texas. He's been in the trenches, educating the masses on the truth behind the empire's lies. And today, he's blessing our viewers and listeners with his expert military analysis, activism experience, and anti-imperialist education. He's the co-host of Colonial Outcasts and State of Play on Mint Press. He is the one and only Greg Stoker.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. Yeah. And thanks for having me. I'm glad we finally were able to make this work. It's been trying for months.
Yeah. It feels like longer than that. But yeah, it's so much has happened. I mean, our last episode was July of 2023. So much has gone down since then. And I was like, Greg is the perfect person to help us out, catch us up to speed.
Like, I guess the assault on Lebanon, Syria.
Yeah.
Now, starting off the new year, 2025, with a couple of domestic terrorist attacks.
For sure.
So
I don't even know. Like, yeah, I'm
look, strap in. It's gonna get. Yeah. It's literally gonna get worse before it gets worse.
For sure. And then just wanted to let the viewers and listeners know that this episode is sponsored by Palestinian Hustle. Samer graciously provided some merchandise for us, based also in Florida, where I'm originally from, and we're going to try to make him come out here one of these days. But yeah, he's keeping faith in us, and I owe a lot to him. So appreciate you, Samer, and we will talk about them a little bit later in the episode. But yeah, let's get started. Low-hanging fruit, your military background. Let's get into that. Let's get a little bit about that history and how you became who you are today as an activist.
Well, I guess the glib thing, the glib version of events would be like I got lost on my way to college, but there's a lot of reasons I didn't want to go to college. It's not a unique story. Family issues growing up. I wasn't a good student, which meant scholarships were not a thing.
Right.
Plus, I was from a demographic where it'd be kind of like unfair to go down that route. But I felt like I didn't really have any marketable skills, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to be controlled anymore by like my father's money. So I just ran off after getting expelled from school, and I enlisted as an infantryman in the U.S. Army. So about, I don't know, 48 hours after I got my high school diploma, I was on a bus to Fort Benning, Georgia to start basic infantry training. It wasn't an ideological thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was third generation Army, and maybe that kind of like played into me like needing to like prove myself, mm-hmm. or something like that. But it was more like, I don't have anywhere else to go.
So your dad didn't like force you to do that, or?
No, he actually laughed in my face when I was like, I'm gonna try out for Ranger selection. And he's like, oh, you're gonna make it in special operations? You've never finished anything in your life.
Oh, so you're like,
so yeah, it was not like, yeah. It was, I mean,
maybe he did like some there was
definitely some like fuck you dad going in there. I think like out of our class, like of 300 that were in selection, about 28 ended up graduating.
Wow.
And we were just like standing in formation, freezing as they were like getting shipped off the bus to like the 101st Airborne or the 82nd Airborne divisions, because they didn't get into special operations, but they were still airborne qualified. Mm-hmm. So they went to like airborne infantry. And okay. I guess we're just kind of like joking, like guys totally didn't hate their dads enough.
Yeah.
So it was, yeah. And, you know, I grew up more of a liberal in a liberal background, mm-hmm. but I think over the past year, we've learned that liberal ideology and conservative ideology is
the same.
They're both ideologies of war.
Right.
So,
sure.
You know, because they're both based off of liberalism, which is a part of an economic system that, you know, is the wellspring for imperialism and then colonialism and then finally the highest stage, genocide, which we're seeing right now. So, yeah, of course, I had some like ideas. I had some problematic ideas about the global war on terror, but there was so much cognitive dissonance surrounding it. Luckily, I was too young to have gone to Iraq. Mm-hmm. My first deployment was when Obama first came in, and that's when we started the Afghan surge. So all the Rangers were out of Iraq by that time and had relocated to Afghanistan. Which was a completely different battle space. People equate it like they're the same war, but they're not. They're part of the same like global effort to wash money out of the private public sector into the private sector, and also to, you know, do what imperialism does best, make a very small amount of people a lot of money, and to dominate West Asia, which is the most probably important strategic location on earth. So is Afghanistan, though, because it's like on a border with China, next to Russia, India. But yeah, I wasn't like, yes, sir, Captain America. I actually ended up getting in trouble a lot. I did 5 years, which was my first contract, because one of my childhood dreams was actually to not be in the military. I just wanted to do one contract in special operations, get field experience, go to an Ivy League school, which I ended up going to Columbia for a little bit, and then go to Langley and do CIA stuff. But after my experiences in Afghanistan and education about like in post-colonial studies in college, I was like, you know what? Nah, I'm gonna go into film, you know?
Yeah.
never really made anything in that, but
You know, you're doing pretty good work now.
So now I end up on film, but not in like a artistic way. So, I guess that's it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. I did 4 deployments. I was primary assault team leader, a field interrogator. And when people hear interrogations, it's like, yeah, but I never practiced like negative incentives. Mm-hmm. I didn't think they worked. Plus, that's not my personality type where I get off on that. So there's a whole spectrum. Like there's positive incentives, which is like money, flattery, we're going to help you. Yeah. And all the way to negative incentives, which is like threat, food, sleep deprivation, all the way to torture. Just kidding. Yeah. America doesn't torture. We just use enhanced interrogation techniques.
But that has water.
Right? Yeah.
A lot of water is involved. Yeah, so I'm assuming that, like, was there a point where you were in the field or doing this stuff where you just kind of had this aha moment where you're like, wow, when I'm done with this, I'm going to completely switch gears and do what you're doing today, or kind of evolved into that?
Not really. I was thinking about this more recently because I used to think it was like an education about how this was wrong of the educational variety. Like there wasn't like one epiphanal moment. But it came on my last deployment where I was pretty much just in a strictly intelligence role where I was plugged into the targeting cycle for kinetic strikes. Mm-hmm. So drone strikes mostly. Right. There just really wasn't any standard of proof for who was being hit and why they were being hit. Like if you could, if you ended up on the wrong contact list because you were some Taliban affiliate's baker, and that's the word that they used, affiliate. Really, how do you define affiliate? You know, Israel does the same thing in Gaza. They're Hamas affiliate. It's a 14-year-old Hamas affiliate whose cousin may be in the civilian sector of Hamas.
Yeah.
And so
affiliate.
So like and I'm not trying to like go on tangents, yeah. but it's not that they're, well, they objectively are targeting civilians, intentionally.
Sure.
I cannot, even though I'm disgusted by the global war on terror, and I'm now an anti-war activist, I cannot, if I'm being honest, think of a single instance where, you know, people are like, oh, we're going to do a punitive strike, kill a bunch of civilians, and that will teach them. It was more like they just didn't care because mm-hmm. there was certain metrics of collateral damage where, you know, lawyers would sign off on them. And it was all very like bureaucratic and litigious. So that gave people some like shield psychologically from thinking like, oh, we're actually the bad guys because, you know, it's legal and we have lawyers signing off on it. But yeah, Israel doesn't even do that. They have rogue targeting cells just doing whatever the fuck they want. So
it's AI now, isn't it?
Yeah, but we don't really know what the actual algorithm is.
Sure.
All we can see is if we drop a heat map of where all the bombs on Gaza are dropped, of like a population density map, and then drop a heat map of all the kinetic strike locations, yeah. they're the same. So it looks like the AI is just being like, where are the most people? Okay. Mm. And it, you know, what I was talking to Paul Bigger about this. He was the CEO for Tech for Palestine. Mm-hmm. He, you know, had this interesting quote. It's like, you never give a machine responsibility because you can't hold a machine responsible.
Sure.
So it's like, how do you prosecute war crimes if an AI is doing it? Do you prosecute the guy who designed the AI? Do you prosecute the guy who implemented it?
Right.
You know, so what do you do? But anyways, circling back to the original thing, it was the Obama's insane drone strike policy.
Sure.
Not just in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan was done like pretty cleanly opposed to other theaters. You know, there was, you couldn't even hit civilian infrastructure because we were doing counterinsurgency operations and trying to not get people to hate us and join the Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, even though Al-Qaeda really wasn't at point. It's like proto-Islamic state happening, but there was mostly foreign fighters. But the Taliban, a lot of whom were from Pakistan, though, so it was a mess.
Yes.
But you just didn't want to piss everybody off. So, like, we couldn't even hit roads. But, like, Libya, Yemen, other things that I was watching going on, the Syrian dirty war. And it started off in civil war, but then it became problematic. And we can talk about that as well, because I almost went to Syria.
As a Ranger?
Yeah. If I had re-enlisted, I would have. But I totally prepared to, and I had a top secret security clearance at the time. So we're prepping for that. It never happened because I got it to Columbia. And I was like, you know what? I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go to college. It was basically the drone strikes. And also, coming down from the White House, there was just like an operational mandate. You know, when cops have quotas, like you need to arrest this many people for speeding. It's like, you guys need to have this many operations. It's like, yeah, well, we don't have any good intelligence on any of this. So either like you'd walk into a booby trap or you just like blow down the door of some like random families and you'd be like, my bad, guys. And that was embarrassing.
Yeah.
And also alienating. Yeah, the whole process.
It makes the world hate the U.S.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the, I've seen conflicting numbers, but you know, maybe on the more conservative side, the amount of deaths that we've caused is maybe specifically in Afghanistan from disease and, you know, just the war in general was
displacement
in the millions, right?
There's also a lot of sectarian violence.
Sure.
But that wouldn't have existed if we never invaded in the first place. So
yeah.
The buck stops with the invading force.
Yeah.
But I've seen a lot of different numbers. I don't think we'll ever really know, but it was significant.
Yeah.
And for what? Taliban are still in power.
Really? I mean, man, so yeah, that covers your. So, is there anything else you wanted to cover on about your anti-imperialist or activist background?
I mean, it took 10 years to get for me to get out of the Army to be where I am now. Yeah. It was like a long educational process, sure. You know, and even over the past year, I've been educated more and more.
And how did you, I mean, I feel like you've had a meteoric rise on social media. So how did that come about? Did you just start posting videos of yourself talking and it just kind of caught?
Yeah, fire? it was October 10th. And that's when the punitive air strike.
2023.
Okay. My buddy, Travis, he's on our Colonial Outcast podcast when we do an operational breakdown episode. That's sure. What we call it. It's
that's you, Mark, and sometimes
or it's Travis. Me, Travis, sometimes other people from other branches of the military. And we look at what's going on and we try to give a strategic and tactical analysis of events. He was a former field grade West Point artillery officer who did 2 combat deployments to Iraq. Also, he's at all the major anti-war actions with Veterans for Peace with me. He called me on October 10th and he was just like, dude, are you fucking seeing this? I was like, yeah, I'm seeing this. It looks like they're dropping 1,000-pound JDAMs in Gaza. And then we watched CNN, and I'm not sure who it was. I'm not sure if it was Mike Pompeo, the former evangelical Zionist, former director of the CIA under Trump, or if it was General Petraeus, who is bought and paid for, or some other like colonel-level military pundit being like, yes, we had to do this. In Iraq, we did this in Afghanistan. Like, this is like correct targeting practices. And I'm like, motherfucker, no, we didn't. I just said it earlier in the episode that we couldn't even drop a road, you know, in rural areas. So doesn't mean they didn't kill a lot of people through drone strikes, but we weren't dropping JDAMs in Baghdad.
Right.
With the exception of the initial shock and awe campaign. But those were, from everything I've seen, military targets. So, yeah, I'm not apologizing for American combat interventionism, but, like, that wasn't true, and it pissed me the fuck off because it was, like, it was putting these field grade and general officers in front of the American people and saying, yeah, yes, we did that, when no, we didn't. At least not in my experience, at least who was had a TSSCI in Afghanistan, and it wasn't the experience of the guy who was in the fire control center, Travis, in Baghdad when all these fire missions were going on. So it's just like, when? Like, what are you talking about? So that pissed me off. And then it became really clear when they started targeting hospitals and water desalination. Well, actually, there's
all civilian infrastructure, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, yes, this is war. They're fighting a counterinsurgency to defeat Hamas. So, like, when we did counterinsurgency operations, there was this acronym called SWEAT MSO. It stands for sewage, water, electricity, academics, trash, medical safety, and other. And it stipulates that if you're the occupying power, you need to protect these sites. And if they get damaged, you need to send in contractors immediately to repair them. Because it turns out that, like, if people don't have the basic functions of life when you're the occupying force, they want to kill you. And it's to mitigate the thrust for insurgency. Because most people don't want to die violently.
Sure.
But there's a lot of people on the fence, and if life becomes like super unlivable, they'll make that decision.
Yeah.
So that was like one of the first things I talked about, just about the hypocrisy of it and how their entire strategy doesn't make sense. You know, it didn't work in Vietnam, didn't work in Iraq, didn't work in Afghanistan. It just simply won't work. And I didn't like being gaslit and I didn't like being lied to. So I started making videos because there was no other like media, like influencers on the left. I'm politically like actually left, not a liberal left, but
So this is Israel's Vietnam essentially. And the US is Vietnam 2.0.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to last 10 years though. I don't think it can.
I mean, it's lasted 76 plus?
Yes.
Back and forth.
Yeah. Okay. Let me rephrase the hot shooting war.
Yeah.
The high intensity operation phase. It's unprecedented for Israel that's used to short, violent wars where they just drop a bunch of bombs with their US toys.
Yeah.
6 weeks, 2 months. But now we're, I don't know, Andy. Year plus of sustained combat operations.
Yeah. I think I have this on the notes somewhere, but we might as well bring it up since it came up. But yeah. like, I always say to people, like, this is a war of attrition, right? Mm-hmm. I always say that Israel has to completely win. The resistance just has to not lose.
Yeah.
So that's like that. It's almost impossible to beat the indigenous force that's from that land, that knows the territory, that's just like has basically home field advantage. It just never really works out historically.
Yeah, and there's only been like one successful counterinsurgency operation of a Western power, and that was the Brits in like the 50s, I believe, in South Asia. But even that didn't last. So and there's not really a precedent for it working.
Yeah. So I don't. Will they ever learn their lesson? That's a rhetorical question, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, as the war machine keeps turning, people will make money.
Sure. And I think it's. The number is like over $300 billion since Israel's inception has been given from the U.S. to Israel for in aid and, you know, obviously war.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a staggering number. People like to say like, oh, that's just a drop in the bucket of the, you know, trillion dollar budget that the U.S. has. But
yeah,
what could we have done with that money? Like how you're a veteran, how veterans are treated when they come back. The homeless crisis, healthcare. I mean, you see with what's happening.
Even one of the aid packages, even one of the small aid packages, like $20 billion can solve homelessness in America. So drop in the bucket, but like, yeah, so much of the money, though, is already allocated for with like Social Security and Medicaid and stuff like that. So like anything that's disposable that you don't need to spend on killing children would be nice if it went back to the American
people. Americans, it's like we're seeing our taxes, especially me, as an American, as a Lebanese American, we're paying taxes to bomb and kill our own people. And it's disturbing to the highest degree.
Yeah, you know, and you don't have a choice in paying taxes or not.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, 2025, the year we all don't pay taxes. How about that?
Mm.
You heard it here first.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, all right. Well, I think, staggering number. You know, a lot of the homeless people are veterans, right? So
there are a lot of homeless veterans. Yeah.
So they think that they're going to get this nice, you know, GI Bill package that when they come back and they get thrown on the streets and they don't care about them. And our own, we go and fight. I think Serge Tankian and System of a Down, like when it was like 2005 when they dropped BYOB, which is bring your own bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might have been about that those wars that you were talking about. And one of their phrases is like, why don't the presidents fight the war? Why do they always send the poor? And that I was like 12 at the time when I heard that. And that was kind of like my eye opening moment. I was like, oh, yeah, they have a point. They're just sending these chess pieces to do their bidding. And did you feel like that's what it felt like when you were over there?
Yeah, well, you know, there's something called the poverty draft, which is where, you know, it's not an official draft, but it's like you come from bumfuck Arkansas.
Yeah.
And, you know, you want dental and you want to get out of there. What are you going to do? You're going to join the army. Plus, you all also have a bunch of propaganda being like, yeah, you should serve the country because it's really taking care of you,
right.
You know, in your freaking trailer. And also there's complete empirical data that the casualty gap has steadily increased since Vietnam. Casualty gap meaning the gap between rich kids who die in a war and poor kids who die in a war. It's been widening since Vietnam, and it's heavily not even middle class, but like lower income middle too. So that's also happening as well. So that's fun. You know, it's just like late stage finance capitalism. We're just going to go continue to see this disparity between the top 1% and everybody else.
Right. Oh, you mentioned your podcast name is Colonial Outcasts.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does that mean? And what does that mean to you?
Okay. Well, we started this as a couple of white guys, and within like white supremacist culture, which I grew up not around, but adjacent to, just because I was in Texas and my granddad had a cattle ranch out in Arkansas. So encountered those people a lot. And also, it's not just like poor rural places. It's also like ivory tower institutions as well. If you question Western imperialism and colonialism, they're like, what's wrong with you? Like there's, you're a Westerner.
Yeah.
Like, why are you talking about this? At the worst, you're called a race traitor. Just be like, why are we fighting this war? And, you know, I've been called that too. And like, God forbid you become a revert, then you're just a straight up, they see it as a mental illness. But there's this idea, and especially like during the 19th century, during the height of the British Empire, where yeah. people would like question these things and they'd be like shunned from society. So it's kind of that idea. We're just like white dudes trying to educate other white people about this.
Yeah.
Because you're able to leverage that to get them to fucking listen. And I'm a veteran, so we use that too, but it's the idea is like, yeah, you get around questioning colonialism or imperialism, there are certain aspects of whiteness, which isn't really a culture. It's just this thing that erases culture into like one thing that you need to toe the line, and it's inherently fascist. But yeah, you get outcast for it. So.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's all of you are veterans on the show?
No, through 3 to 4 of myself and some regular contributors. But okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are like the A team of you know, whites, you know, educating other white people against like, you know, this crazy amount of misinformation and disinformation campaigns all over social media. So,
yeah. Well, we know how to do it too. Obviously, being of European descent is fundamentally important to that. But, you know, we also know how to talk to these people because we grew up with them. It's like, do you hate Democrats? Do you like guns?
Yeah.
You know, there's it's ways like, to do it. So,
well, you guys all being veterans, you know, have you guys talked about, let's say, you know, the U.S.'s complicity in worldwide destabilization and like how people don't understand just how deep, you know, the U.S. and even Israel's hands go into destabilizing and toppling governments and pretty much the entire world.
Oh yeah, democracies especially. Any especially, God forbid, it's a socialist democracy that has to die immediately. Right. No socialist project outside of Western Europe can exist because it's a fundamental threat. So destabilize it, replace it with a far right fascist government that, you know, will do what the wealth concentrations within the country influenced by the United States foreign interests will do. And right. We control fascist governments because they exist to protect corporate power, disenfranchise the lower class, and, you know, basically be thugs and make very small percentage of capitalists and landowners money.
Yeah.
And that's why they're able to control them. And of course, because, you know, fascist governments or far-right governments can be tenuous with their grip on power, they will always necessitate the need for U.S. weapons, intelligence support,
yeah.
and political cover and backing.
So is that essentially, in a nutshell, why the U.S. and Israel are aligned?
You say? Like birds of a feather. I mean, Israel's into that for a lot of different reasons. Like, yeah, you know, there's this idea that Israel controls the United States. And yes, it's true that there are like these foreign lobbies like AIPAC.
AIPAC, yeah.
And that, you know, the Mossad and the CIA work hand in hand and they're like in lockstep. And that's just not entirely true at all. There is a bunch of intelligence sharing going on, but there's also a lot of mistrust. Mm. So there's something called the FAO course. The Foreign Area Officer course, which is what you go into the military if you're going to be like a foreign advisor in another country. And like one of the first things you learn is about adversarial collection, like who will collect the most on you personally, try to get your dirt, try to approach you, try to manipulate you, blackmail you, bribe you. It's not China. It's not Russia. It's Israel. So like there are evangelical politicians and political operatives, in Washington that will support Israel no matter what. But there's also a lot of mistrust within yeah. the intelligence community against Israel.
Sure.
So it's not this perfect like relationship either. There's some adversarial things that go on as well. there's a lot of people in the military that are beyond frustrated with Israel and do not see them as a strategic ally. But there's something I saw, especially in Afghanistan, there's a big distance between like what military people wanted and analysts wanted and commanders wanted and what politicians wanted. So that was another big thing about
a Floridian, congressperson literally wearing the IDF uniform in our own Congress. It's disgusting to see, to be honest.
But also he was never in the IDF.
Yeah.
And he was actually in the US Army.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, that's embarrassing.
Yeah. That's to put it.
It's like you're a pro sport player, but wearing some other dude from another team's jersey.
It's like, disgusting. What's wrong with you? And then additional to all that, I mean, like the distrust you're talking about within the U.S. and the, you know, intelligence and Israeli intelligence, it goes as far as to, you know, the major egregious one was the USS Liberty attack. Mm-hmm. And how can the U.S. align with somebody that has attacked us in multiple different facets, basically. And that was the most egregious attack.
I was talking about this again with Travis New Year's Eve. I mean, it was kind of a late night conversation, but let's just leave it at that. But so one thing about like when I hear, you know, as much as I support what the Houthis are doing, they will say things like they hit a U.S. capital ship, like the U.S. is Enterprise. Like, dude, if you hit a capital ship, like the response is going to be insane.
Yeah.
Basically, there's this saying in the military, just don't touch the boats. Whatever you do, shoot down aircraft, fine. But if you touch the boats, there's going to be a massive interventionist military response. So that's why I'm always like, okay, well, Houthis know that, probably not going to get into that. Because like we will literally start a war if you touch the boats. Like, if it was anyone else but Israel, you know, it would have been a whole massive international incident. But nope, under the rug. Greatest ally. I mean,
it was like 27 killed.
It was more than that. Yeah, most people had severe burns. Hundreds were wounded. Over 100 were wounded.
So, yeah. I mean, some people survived that and they still talk about it to this day. And nobody, like, I feel like it's not as big as it should have been. So I don't know.
If any other country hit a ship, it would be a thing. Yeah. Don't touch the boats unless you're Israel.
Unless you're Israel.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, let's move on to more current events.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we have a lot to catch up on in a short period of time with, you know, Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. So maybe we can summarize it.
Well, first of all, Lebanon. I don't know when this episode is going to come out, but ceasefire will probably be over by then. So unless there's another interim measure and unless Israel withdraws from southern Lebanon, which it says it won't, we're going to see that kick off again.
Yeah.
And they're actively bombing Syria. And that brings us to so what's going to happen in Lebanon, it's going to pick up again, but now they're still deployed in Gaza. They're deployed in West Bank, enforced, the IDF being they. Then they're going to reopen the Lebanese front, and now they're in Syria. Okay, good luck, guys. I know you have a recruiting crisis, so I'm sure that'll work out.
Is this like the final, like, lash out before, you know, this empire crumbles?
Well, you know what I see happening? It's like the extinction burst, late-stage colonial violence. So, like, this conflict will end, right? And I don't think it'll be like Israel's just going to disappear.
Yeah.
But it's going to go through an irreparable decline. So how long does that take? Well, every colonial project differs. But there's a through line and a trend. And there's just so many Americans that don't support it. A lot of Americans on the right, and they don't support Israel for like the right reason. I mean, there are reasons that they don't want us to keep supporting Israel, and they want us to have a more adversarial stance towards Israel. But it's basically mainly just because they're like neo-Nazis. But there's a lot of them, like, you know, Jake Shields.
Yeah.
He's now platforming David Duke. So, and he hates Israel. So, you know, they're not allies.
Yeah.
They're incredibly problematic. But if you want to turn Israel into a pariah state in the United States, they're not unuseful. They're just the wolf that will devour anybody. So,
sure.
So, one thing that happened, and I know we kind of have an abbreviated episode that we have to talk about, is Syria. I tried my best to thread that needle. There's a lot of black and white thinking on this issue. And of course, I'm an outsider, a Westerner. Even when we were preparing to go to Syria, just reading about all the rebel groups and the shifting alliances and who we're funding and not funding, and the propaganda war that was being waged both outside of Syria and within Syria, from Western foreign intelligence agencies, it was just a mess. And I think some things have been like deeply unhelpful, in terms of allowing it to affect people's like unity over Palestine. Like I get why. I mean, Assad, everything about him wasn't like CIA propaganda.
I'm just kidding.
What?
I hate that his last name is my first name. So.
Okay. Bashar.
Fun fact, in the 20s, I believe Hafez al-Assad, the father, changed their name from Hafez al-Wahsh, mm-hmm. which means the beast, to Assad, which is lion. So they want it to be more regal. And I'm salty about that. Now that I have to see my name dragged through the mud. Assad that.
Only for like six more months. Like this. Like, yeah.
For sure.
I mean, some of the emotions are already dying down.
I mean, this is that they are like the HTS group. That's supposedly acting as the rulers there. Like, they're backed by, you know, the U.S. and Israel for sure, right?
I'll just say this. I mean, I haven't seen any documentation.
Yeah,
I can't say for certain. But here's a trend. If you're Al Qaeda or former Islamic State, and you want to go legit, you turn Western asset. We have ex-Al-Qaeda guys that were responsible for bombing the USS Cole before 9/11, which is a Navy ship where American sailors died. The BBC World did a documentary about American mercenaries in Yemen, and they pretty much established that ex-Al-Qaeda leadership involved with attacking the USS Cole is now actively, as a Western asset, fighting the Houthis in Yemen. So, yeah, it's a long-standing tradition if you're ex-Al-Qaeda and you're not about that life anymore and you want to go legit and stop being hunted, you can, you know, use all your influence and knowledge of that shadow world to, you know, become an asset and, you know who your benefactors are. Know who's giving you political cover. I don't know if the U.S. is arming HTS or funding HTS,
yeah.
But they are providing an immense amount of political cover for HTS to rewrite their history and establish themselves as a legitimate government that has the democratic mandate of the people. Hmm. Do I think they'll be better than Assad? I hope so. But the thing about like Jelani, everyone wants to, you know, focus on him being a former head chopper. Yeah, it takes a certain kind of freaking sociopath person to do that. But then again, he's saying all the right things, doing all the right things. He knows which side his bread is buttered on. And if he goes too far right and to the place where the U.S. can't support him anymore, yeah, he's going to be in trouble. And he's a political animal. He's a survivalist. He's betrayed every commander he's ever worked for. So there is some hope that he will at least play nice enough to, I don't know. My big fear is that Syria is going to be balkanized.
Balkanized?
Balkanized.
Yeah.
Turned into a neo-Balkan state. So we'll see.
Because, you know, Turkey's involved, Russia's involved.
Okay. Yeah. Literally every country that can power project into that region,
yeah,
is involved.
Right.
The Arab governments that are comprador governments with Western imperialism, essentially, with the exception of the, I don't know, the Houthis, which, you know, the West doesn't recognize as a legitimate government, is basically saying normalize with Israel. We want normalization. We want this pipeline to go through Syria into Europe. Let's make it happen, guys. So, yeah. I mean, the region could stabilize. No, I don't think anyone can say with any certainty what it's going to look like for Syria. I just know that Jelani said, as of recording this interview 2 days ago, that it will take 4 years for democratic elections to occur.
Yeah, I
could get like 2 years because like all the state institutions, but actually that doesn't make sense because most people have gone back to work working for the same same institutions that they worked for in the government. So why do you need 4 years? That's a concern. But then again, saying with any certainty what it's going to look like, and I hope it works out for the best. In terms of like Palestinian resistance, everyone's like, oh, Assad did this and that. It's like, okay, Assad was really the linchpin of the axis of resistance. Really? Like, come on, guys. It's a blow, and Iran's going to have to rethink its foreign policy before Trump takes office, but it's not going to stop. It hasn't stopped since before 47.
Sure.
And one of the biggest benefit, and I know we only have like 7 minutes left, is that a lot of these colonial projects end because of what people in the imperial core think about them when they become unacceptable. And what's happened over the past year? People have been getting quite the education about Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it has become a complete pariah state. They want to, you know, we might have this TikTok ban with the Trump inauguration coming. I mean, Israelis like to say, you know, if the hostages aren't coming back or released or returned, Trump is going to, like, just wait until Trump, like, this threat.
Yeah, Trump also said that the war in Ukraine would end before he got into office. And then Foreign Minister Lavrov, is essentially the same job that Anthony Blinken has as Secretary of State, said, nope, war in Ukraine's not ending. So already whiffed that one. Yeah, so might probably will whiff the hostages too. I don't think he's – what campaign promise has he ever delivered on? I can't think. I kind of like blocked out that presidency. But this one's going to be a doozy, especially now that him and his friend, Elon Musk, is going to start beefing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think the Trump government's going to fall apart, or at least the administration is going to be so fractured by infighting that they're not really going to be able to effectively destroy the Constitution like they want to. So that's cool. In terms of Israel, the education people have, I'll just say that, like, as an anti-war veteran activist, I just bring up Vietnam a lot. 10 years. Probably would have gone on for another 10 if Americans were just like, yeah, cool, let's keep funding this. Let's go to war for what? So that's what ended Vietnam. I mean, obviously the resistance from the Viet Cong and how they weren't going to go away.
Right.
But they would have just kept the war going if they could.
Yeah.
Indefinitely, forever, because we like forever wars. It's only when consent in America dries up, that's when they end. So it's drying up. So that's a sliver of more than a sliver of hope in the wake of the fall of the Bashar,
right?
The Bashar regime.
So I feel like, if I remember correctly, at the very end of Trump's term, there was this like Trump looked like he turned his back on Netanyahu and then maybe backstabbed him. So possibly, do you think that might happen? You said something about drying up. So do you think the U.S. will turn its back to Israel during Trump, like some kind of plot twist, or what do you think?
I think things are going to get so bad economically and politically that people aren't going to want to deal with another country's bullshit.
Yeah, they're trying to give...
Like, people on the right are already turning on Israel in droves. Sure. Aside from the hardened group of like massive Islamophobes and Christian evangelical Zionists, like, you know, Israel's losing the Nazi vote. I'm just kidding. I hate to put it that way. Yeah.
That's going to be our headline, you know?
Nazis used to love Israel because they killed brown people.
Sure.
But now they're doing things that Nazis don't like, sending foreign aid and getting involved in other countries'
wars. Money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's almost like fascists only really care about money.
Man. Yeah. I mean, I wish we could get into, you know, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria more, but obviously check out Greg's page for more analysis as this goes on. I mean, I always turn to you about my own country. You know, Talal is Palestinian, Atif is Lebanese, and I'm Lebanese. So it's hard to see it from the inside. So seeing it from the outside provides pretty good, you know, insight. So I'm always grateful for your information that you give on your pages. Make sure you, what's your Instagram handle?
Oh, it's greg.j.stoker.
Right.
Yeah. And I think you have to type it in correctly because I'm so shadow banned that if you don't type it in correctly, you can't find it.
Because, okay. And one last topic quickly, conflict fatigue. What is it? And what can we do for 2025? I mean, everyone's looking for answers. How are we going to feel better about ourselves and not burn out and just keep the good fight going?
Conflict fatigue. Well, you know, again, bringing up the Vietnam backlash, you know, that lasted for 10 years. Do you think the original activists were hitting the street every day for 10 years? No. It's insane. People have jobs. People have lives. People need to have, like, social relationships and things to do. So there'll be sometimes you come in and sometimes you don't. This is going to go on for years because even when the bullets stop and the bombs stop falling, there's still going to be massive land grabs happening in West Bank. And there's going to be a new war, maybe over the Strait of Taiwan. It's all part of the same system. So basically, activists mobilize against issues, revolutionaries mobilize against systems. So just mobilizing against the entire system. So, like, yeah, you know, you can take a break from Palestine for a minute and be like, oh, fucking healthcare. It's part of the same system. Oh, police, National Guard in the New York subway system. Same system, same issue, literally. So you can hop between issues because they're all connected. You can also take a break for a little bit. Conflict fatigue is where you just get too invested in watching atrocities that you're just like, because you're a human being and you're not actually living in a conflict zone. If you're living in the actual conflict zone, it'd be way worse.
Right.
But it's just not sustainable.
Yeah. So, and I think at this point we also got to lean on community, and
that's another big part of it as well. So maybe later on this spring or something, I can come back on and talk about that.
Yeah. And you know, we're gonna wrap up this episode one more time. This episode is sponsored by Palestinian Hustle. Use code Habibi House for 20% off your next purchase. And Greg, thank you so much for coming on. I know this is like the express episode. Hopefully we can have you on.
Hey, well, you know, just starting off the new year running.
Yeah.
You know?
This is a great first episode, and we're gonna, as you said, buckle up. Let's see what happens, and hopefully we can, you know, be on your show soon on Colonial Outcast. So
absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you so much. Great.
All right. Cheers, y'all. Appreciate you. Yeah. Thanks, man.